Daniel chapter 11. Some people think this is one of the more tedious chapters in the Bible. I guess I'm sort of a weirdo because I really like this chapter. I think it's a great chapter, and it's kind of one of those chapters where I think it does require us to do a little thinking, maybe even perhaps writing down some notes and stuff like that. I guess what I'm going to say about chapter 11 is we're only going to scratch the surface on the detail that's given to us here in chapter 11. But there's plenty of information to study. In fact, the history that's going to unfold, history to us, prophecy to Daniel, it's so exacting and so precise. It's pretty fun to study and learn about how this history actually did unfold as it was given to Daniel the prophet. Now, there is a bit of a setup I need to do, especially if you're kind of just joining us or you haven't been here for a few weeks. You got to kind of remember Daniel, the book of Daniel, the first six chapters, people say those are the practical chapters. And people say then the 7 through 12 are the prophetic chapters. And I can understand that. And I even have used that division myself. But in the same way, one thing you need to understand is all through the book of Daniel, there's this commonality of the nation Israel, the nations that would come and be over Israel and over the whole region of the known world at that time, the nations that would come and go, and how it would lead up to the very end of time, the end of the world. And we saw that even in the stories, kind of embedded in the stories of Daniel, you know, in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We saw in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And we saw the nations of the statue there, the gold head, Babylon, the arms, Mede and Persian, the Medo-Persian Empire. The belly of brass was the Greek Empire led by Alexander the Great. Then, of course, the iron legs of Rome. And then the 10 toes. Now, if you'll remember, there was a big break between the iron legs of Rome and then the 10 toes that would come out of those iron legs. There was a big time gap. And there, Daniel chapter 2, it said, in the days of those 10 toes, or the kings of those 10 toes, would the Messiah come and set up his kingdom to rule and reign on this earth. And so we saw that prediction, that prophecy in Daniel chapter 2. We also saw in other passages, of course, you know, where we read about Daniel 7, Daniel chapter 8, about nations and kings that would come and go. And there was always this break and gap somewhere where it would talk about seemingly ancient times to us, and then suddenly click into modern day, end times, last days scenarios. And so that's a commonality throughout Daniel. We see that gap in there. We saw it in Daniel chapter 9. The 70 weeks of Daniel, the first 69 weeks we read about. And we learned that last week, but then there was a big gap. The gap is the church age. That is when Jesus Christ would die, his disciples would spread the gospel throughout all the world, and all while the church age is going, it seems that the stopwatch is stopped as it relates to the nation Israel. But a key understanding is to know that Israel, God is not done with Israel. The stopwatch may be paused, but it's going to click into gear once again, and that will be when the tribulation period starts. That's the 70th week of Daniel. We looked at that on Wednesday night last week. So if you missed that one, I'd really recommend that you could catch up on that one, because that's a key in your understanding of the way all this stuff's going to come down. Well, Daniel chapter 11, what happens? Well, in Daniel 10, we saw on Sunday, this angel shows up after Daniel had been praying. He'd been praying for 21 days, and this angel is withheld by the prince of Persia. We found out that there are demonic powers that are holding back angels, and the Lord is orchestrating events, and there's this cosmic battle that we don't see, but it really is there. But as Daniel pressed in through prayer, how the Lord sending Michael the archangel to come, I guess his was the deciding vote in the battle of the angel, the messenger that was going to Daniel, and this prince of Persia, Michael shows up, it's the end of the discussion, and this angel, which I believe is possibly, and maybe even probably, Gabriel. He shows up and says, Daniel, I'm about to show you some huge stuff. And he said, you're greatly beloved, and there's all kinds of things that the angel told Daniel we looked at on Sunday. But now, this angel is going to give Daniel the message, the vision, the prophecy, as it concerns the world. particularly that region of the world, of the Middle East, and what the future holds. And this prophecy is exacting. We are about to read from chapter 11, verses 1 through 35. We're going to read 135 different prophecies that are very specific, all of which have come to pass perfectly. Now, the reason we stop at verse 35, because in chapter 11, when we move into verse 36 and onward, we suddenly have this shift of gears. There are some descriptions concerning this coming world leader, which we would call the Antichrist. There are descriptions there that do not pertain to the history that unfolded in Israel. Well, Brett, why is there a gap there? Well, it fits with all of the rest of the book of Daniel. In all these prophecies, there's these prophecies concerning the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, and then there's a stop. In the same way, when the Romans show up in chapter 11, the stopwatch stops. And then we move on to the 70th week of Daniel, or the church age is gone. What event is going to end the church age? The rapture of the church. That's right. Man, that's a key understanding. And by the way, I have to say this from time to time. People come and say, well, Brett, you know, I'm a pre-tribber. And I say, well, so am I. But then, we can agree. But the ones that feel really nervous is, Brett, I'm a post-tribber. Do you still like me? And I would say, absolutely. There's a lot of great Christian people who are post-tribbers. They're just wrong. But, no, I'm just kidding. It's one of those non-essentials of Christian doctrine. I want to make an emphasis there, because too many churches, too many denominations have allowed the end times view. Are you a pre-trib, post-trib, mid-trib, pre-wrath, pan-trib, you know, where you believe it's just all going to pan out at the end. Whatever view you come from, you know what? It's great. On all those debates and all those arguments, you're still saved. You're still Christians. I just believe that we're going to be raptured at just before that tribulation period kicks into gear. It's called the pre-trib rapture view. And as we're raptured, we'll be taken up to be with Jesus in the sky, and all the post-tribbers will be taken up with us, and they'll be changing their notes on the way. But that's just my opinion on that. Now, just FYI, if you wonder about, well, Brett, you know, what about these arguments? Well, I've shared with you on several occasions why I believe in pre-tribulation. And one of the main things, we can talk about all the different things that we've talked about. The 70 weeks of Daniel, to me, is a huge argument for pre-trib. Another one is just God himself. God does not destroy the righteous with the wicked. He doesn't pour out his wrath upon us. Why? Because for his church, for those who believe, he poured out his wrath upon a Christ-rejecting, sinful world. That's what's going to happen according to the book of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and 5. And it says, we are not appointed unto wrath. And just by God's nature, even as he pulls Lot, who was kind of a loser really, but he pulls Lot out of Sodom and Gomorrah before the fire and brimstone falls down. And Abraham had a big debate with God. Are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? And the Lord said, no. And so all throughout the world, well, Brett, wait a minute. Noah and the flood. Noah had to go through the flood. God's man had to go through the flood and endure that time of tribulation. And God brought him through it. So I'm a mid-tribber or a post-tribber. That's fine if you want to believe that. But you're forgetting, before the flood, there was a guy by the name of Enoch who the Bible says he walked with God and he pleased God, and the Lord just took him up alive. He didn't die. He didn't see death, but he was, in a sense, raptured. And then the flood came down and the waters covered the earth, and Noah. So who would Noah be a symbol of? The Jewish people who have rejected Jesus the Messiah and will go through that tribulation period. And so there's all kinds of symbols, and those aren't like just the only. There's a huge list of reasons why I believe in pre-trib rapture. And by the way, when I was a younger guy, I used to teach it more kind of, well, here's what the pre-trib, here's what the post-trib, here's what the mid-trib people all believe. And I used to kind of teach all sides of it. And some of you might say, Brett, why don't you do that? Well, there's not enough time in an evening. And then secondly, I don't believe those other views. I want you to be a pre-tribber. I'll tell you why. You say, well, Brett, that's, you're trying to, hey, I just want you to believe the Bible, and I believe the Bible teaches the pre-trib, and it's the only view, listen, this is huge, It's the only view that the next thing on the list of events that need to happen is the rapture of the church. It's the doctrine of imminence. You see, imminence is not knowing when the Lord's going to come back. But I believe he can come back today. If you are a post-tribber, the Lord cannot come back today. He cannot. Why? Well, God can do it. Not if you're a post-tribber. God can't do anything he wants because, well, there's got to be a temple built in Jerusalem. You've got to see this world leader come on the scene. You've got to see Israel trying to be, taken over by this guy with a peace treaty. There's all kinds of things that are going to go on before that tribulation period's over. And so that's why, that's just one of the things. I just teach it the way I believe. And you're welcome. You're definitely welcome to study other views. But I just urge you to take a hard look at it and be fully persuaded in your own mind. And that's kind of an important thing for you guys to remember. So as we go through all this stuff, now you say, Brett, chapter 11 doesn't really deal with pre-trib, post-trib. Yeah, but some of the things we're about to read, perhaps if we get there tonight, concerning this Antichrist character, some of the things we're going to read, they're kind of scary. They're kind of brutal. But one of the things I love about being a pre-tribber is we escape all of these things. When the Antichrist comes and makes war against the saints, the Jews and the Christians who accept Jesus during the tribulation period, man, it's going to be bloody. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be the worst time on the planet Earth, according to the Bible. Well, Brett, you're just trying to escape these things. Yes, I am. That's right. And Jesus said, pray that you are counted worthy to escape all of these things that are talking about that end time scenario. Now, all of this, you might say, Brett, you really believe. Now, some of you are going to say, yeah, great, we're with you, Brett, on that. We know the pre-trib, post-trib thing. We understand all that. That's all good. But there are perhaps a few in here who are saying, wait a minute, all you guys in this room believe you're going to disappear? You guys believe there's going to be an Antichrist, this little guy running around the world that's going to lead the... You know, there's all these views about what we're talking about here and this disappearance of the church and all that. And it sounds a little far-fetched. But at the same time, one of the things you have to remember is most of Bible prophecy, as crazy as it may sound to them back in those days, has already come to pass. Tonight we're going to read, if we get that far, about the army from the east that's got 200 million men. When the Apostle John wrote about that in the book of Revelation, right around chapter 9 there, 200 million man army, when John was writing that, there weren't even 200 million people on the planet Earth. You mean there's going to be a 200 million man army someday? Well, I remember reading about, maybe some of you are old enough to remember, when in the 1960s, Radio Peking announced that they could man, outfit, and arm a 200 million man army. No big deal. It's already passed. That was in the 60s. Do you know how many people are in the different areas of Asia and that are going to be involved in this end time skirmish? All these prophecies. And the reason why this Daniel chapter 11 plays into this discussion is Daniel is about to receive a vision from this angel that is so exacting concerning the nations that would come after the Medes and the Persians that it made the skeptics of the Bible say, this chapter, or the whole book of Daniel, but particularly Daniel chapter 11, they say it's a forgery. Somebody added it in later. Somebody snuck it in, and it wasn't originally in the book of Daniel. Who could have known how exactingly, perfectly these things would come down? And so they say somebody snuck it in. They faked it. And I'll show you tonight why that's a lie that your college professors will tell you. Even to this day, I had professors who told me, the book of Daniel is not authentic. And they said, because their logic is so painful, because we know that there's no way they could have known all those things about the Seleucids, the Ptolemies, Alexander the Great, all these things that are going to unfold in Daniel chapter 11. We know nobody could have predicted that. And we're saying as Christians, that's the whole point. God knows the beginning from the end, the Bible tells us. He's the only one who does. No other religion even attempts Bible prophecy like the Bible does. The Muslims, did you know that Muhammad made one prophetic statement in his lifetime? One. And it was this, I shall return to Jerusalem. He didn't say that in the Quran, by the way, because the word Jerusalem is never in the Quran. I find that interesting, as they claim it the third most holy site in all of Islam. But there, as he stated, I shall return to Jerusalem, he never did. And he didn't even mean like in the far future. He meant, while I'm still alive, I'm going to come back to Jerusalem. That'd be like me saying, I'm going to go back to McDonald's someday. You know what I mean? It's like, it's going to happen. But he said, I'm going to go to Jerusalem. And he didn't do it. You see, the point is, only the Bible, whether you're talking about the faith of the Buddhist or the Muslims or any other false religion, nobody attempts to foretell the future. The Bible does all over the place, and it does it with perfect accuracy. Daniel chapter 11, while it might bore some, because it's just a bunch of details on a north and a south army and kings, and they just say, what's the deal with chapter 11? But it's there to say, look how perfect God predicts the beginning from the end. Let's take a look at this, and let's read Daniel chapter 11, verse 1. The angel that met Daniel in chapter 10, he begins speaking, saying, also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and strengthen him. Now, you might think, okay, so this guy came and strengthened Daniel. Well, that happened in the last chapter. But the idea here is when you look at the original language and the sentence structure, Gabriel, or this angel who came, didn't come just to strengthen Daniel. He did that too. But the idea here is he came to strengthen Darius, or Darius, depending on how you want to pronounce that. Darius the Mede, he came to strengthen him as well. Why? Because Darius, whether he was a good guy or a bad guy, it's debatable in history, but you could also say God did strengthen him for his purposes. You see, when kings were raised up in Bible times, some were raised up by the Lord for his purposes, and yet it might shock you to find out who they were. The Bible tells us that God raised up Pharaoh in Egypt for the very purpose of coming against the Jews. That was God's doing. And in Romans chapter 9, everybody debates, wow, you know, why did God do that? And people say, I did it because I wanted to. And that's the end of the discussion. I'm God, you're not. That's kind of what basically Romans chapter 9 is saying. But he raises kings up like Pharaoh, also like Nebuchadnezzar. The Bible says, Nebuchadnezzar is my servant. Now, he served him, but he wasn't a God-worshipping servant. He was just a servant. Whether he knew it or not, he was serving God. In the same way, the Lord is strengthening Darius in this chapter as he's getting ready to see his kingdom turned over to other kingdoms and kings. And the Lord's orchestrating all these events. That's how God knows what's going on. He makes these things happen. And he's behind a lot of these things. So not all of these things, because I believe the Lord leaves room for free will of man, but also the working of Satan himself. But even with all of that, with the free will of man, the working of Satan, God still knows what's going to happen. The word there in Bible theology is that he's omniscient. He's all-knowing. He knows everything. Now, some of us think that we know everything, but not so. God, truly, you work with people that think they know everything. But God does know everything. And so that's how a chapter like this can unfold. God knows what's going to happen. So he goes down. He's going to strengthen Darius, here is the idea. And it says here in verse 2, and now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Okay, so just quickly, there's four kings mentioned here. And they are, if you're wanting to know who's being talked about here, there's Cyrus the Persian and Darius the Mede, but also a guy by the name of Cambyses. He's also one of the three. But then the fourth one is a guy by the name of Xerxes. If you're naming your children, if you're pregnant tonight, you might consider this Bible name. Xerxes for your child as you're considering names. Actually, Xerxes is also probably the same dude as Ahasuerus. Now, if that sounds familiar, maybe you remember from the story of Esther. That's the same leader during that time the book of Esther came down, when Xerxes was to the throne, and also called Ahasuerus. Now, all that's to say, that the fourth king is the one we're kind of focusing on here, not the other guys. So he says the fourth king shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Now this little verse here, verse 2, covers a huge section of history. We won't go into it all tonight, but it's great stuff. Xerxes was a kind of a powerful, wealthy king who you never really knew what he was going to do. But he oftentimes went to battle, and the only way he would win is he just throw literally millions of his men at certain battles and just hope that more of his men didn't die than the other team. And that's kind of how he did it. In fact, probably one of the more famous battles in all of history is the Battle of Thermopylae. Do you guys remember hearing about the Battle of Thermopolis or Thermopylae? What was that? Well, it's interesting. Historians tell us that it was about, well, almost 6,000 Greeks against 2.5 million Medo-Persian soldiers. That's a little bit being outnumbered. But that's why it's such a famous story. Sure, the Greeks got beat at the Battle of Thermopylae, but the most amazing thing is they held them off for 2 days. And it actually was the beginning of the end for the Persian Empire. It was the beginning of the end of Xerxes. That little battle with just a small group of Greek soldiers who said, we're going to fight to the death. We don't care what happens. And man, you know, there's all kinds of military people who study that battle because the Greek army was better trained. They also were holding ground that they were more familiar with. And they also were willing to die for what they believed in. And those that study these things say those elements need to be in place when you go into battle. You have to be willing to die for what you believe in. You have to know the territory you're on, and you have to be really well trained. It makes you wonder about modern day warfare. Do we have the passion to fight in battles today? To die for what we believe in? It makes me wonder as we look back to the World War II generation of men that went and fought for something they were willing to die for. And you wonder if the attitude has changed there quite a bit in our country. I'm worried about that a little bit, frankly, just as an American. I hope that we raise up young men and young women and people in this country who actually believe that there are things worth going to battle for. Some people say, Brett, aren't you supposed to be a peace-loving Christian? Yeah, but the Lord still uses nations and battles and warfare. There's still something that we see in the Bible that God actually does use. The question is, whose side are you on? Are you on the right side or the wrong side? Americans, we always say, you know, God is on our side. I just hope we're on God's side. I hope that's the thing when we're making our decisions of where we're going to battle. But this Battle of Thermopylae, what happened? Well, the Xerxes, the Persian, he actually stirs up a bee's nest with these Greeks. And that's what happens. The Greek Empire starts that battle. Even though they lost the Battle of Thermopylae, the Greeks, they suddenly found a new strength. In those men that died in that battle, they said, man, we can fight with these guys. And so as the years progressed, the Greeks would send little green beret guys in to the Persian Empire, or Xerxes Empire, I should say, and started to really mess with them. And that was going to be the beginning of the end for Xerxes and the beginning of the great Grecian Empire that would ultimately be led by Alexander the Great and conquer the whole world. So, like I said, verse 2 has got a lot in it. And things that you need to kind of remember there. Now, it tells us here in verse 3, and a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. Brett, why are the Bible verses so coded? Why are they so jumbled and sort of sneaky, especially in some of these prophecies and visions? Why is it so mysterious? Interestingly, there is a reason, and that is I believe the Lord sort of encodes some of Bible prophecy so that we wouldn't get it right away. The Lord requires us to dig and understand. Now, also, the book of Daniel tells us in chapter 12 that these words would be sealed up until the time of the end. Prophecy is the only bit of Bible doctrine and theology that actually we will learn more. We will have newer understanding as we get closer to the day of the Lord. It's the only doctrine. If it's a new doctrine that somebody's saying, hey, we got a new way to be saved, you can know that's just false. If it's new, it's not true. Just understand that. But in prophecy, there's this kind of encoded language. By the way, people that lived during the time where Israel wasn't even a nation, it makes sense that they would think, man, all this stuff must be figurative. There's no literal prophecy that's going to be taking place in the end of the world because Israel wasn't even a nation. But as now we see Israel become a nation in 1948 and all these prophecies just falling into place perfectly, we start thinking, oh man, this is all literal. And you really need to. You have to take these things literally now because most of these prophecies have come true perfectly literally. But before they came, for example, if Daniel's just reading about this king that's going to come, the fourth king of Persia is going to come, and then after him is going to rise another king, Daniel will be thinking, huh? What? Who? What? Where? When? But we look backward in history and we see verse 3 and verse 4 have perfectly been fulfilled in one single character. Quiz time. Who is it? Alexander the Great. Now again, if you've been traveling with us, we've seen this several times in our studies. We, of course, saw him in chapter 7 where we saw Alexander who was likened to a leopard in verse 6 of Daniel chapter 7, which had four wings of a fowl and four heads and dominion given to it. Remember that? We saw that. And then we saw, of course, that as the beasts there. But also in chapter 8, we saw that there would be this other beast that would come, the goat. There was the ram, which was the Medes and the Persians, and there was the goat, which was the Greeks. Why is the Lord focusing so much on the Greeks here? Remember in chapter 2, we saw the Greeks all the way down through the Roman Empire and the end of the world. But we seem to, as we get closer to the end of the book of Daniel, zero in mostly on the Greeks. Why? Well, there would come a leader in the Grecian Empire. We've seen him as the little horn thus far, as one of the little horns. There's two little horns in the book of Daniel. One is this powerful world leader that would come after Alexander would be dead and his generals would take over. We saw him, and then we also saw him likened to a second little horn that is called the Antichrist, the coming world leader that's yet to come. The reason I go into this is because that's why this Grecian issue, and that's why we're going to study the Greeks so much here in Daniel chapter 11, is because we're going to get to a guy by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. He's Antiochus the Fourth. So that's the important one that we're going to get to here in Daniel chapter 11. Why? Because he's a type, a picture of, a foreshadowing of the coming world leader that'll be described at the end of Daniel chapter 11. So that's why we're going to now get to this guy, Alexander the Great, and then move on from there. So that's who's the one being talked about here in Daniel chapter 11, right there in verse 3. A mighty king will stand up, Alexander the Great. Now, as we studied before, he'll have what happened after Alexander. Well, on his deathbed, as he was dying, they said, who should we give the kingdom to? And he said, to the strong. And like I said before, that would have made for an interesting little staff meeting the next day. You know, who gets the kingdom? The strong. Well, I'm stronger than you. No, I'm stronger than you. No, so they had this big debate. Well, finally, they gave it to the four generals that stood by Alexander through his campaigns. And those four generals, again, are, for your study, Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. Those are the four. We looked at those guys in chapter 8 as they were talked about the four heads, the four wings, and now we're seeing them as the four winds of heaven in verse 4 of chapter 11. So, of those four, only two are of consequence in Daniel chapter 11. The Ptolemy Empire, and then the Seleucus Empire, or the Seleucid. Those are the ones that are you need to kind of focus on. Why? Because that's where Daniel 11 is going to go. It's going to focus. Why? The other two guys, Cassander and Lysimachus, they end up kind of, as the years go by, fizzling out. But there's a feud that's going to happen between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and it's going to go on for 150 years. And so that's basically what we're going to read about here. This feud that's going to go back and forth, back and forth. And these are the days of our lives in the Middle East. So check it out. Here we go. So it says there in verse 5, the king of the south. Now, just so you can kind of get it in your minds, Ptolemy, the word, it should always make you think of Egypt. Okay, because the Ptolemies were the guys that took over Egypt as well as the Seleucids took over Babylon, Asia, and Syria. The Seleucid Empire would grow, the Ptolemy Empire would grow, but the Seleucids were, picture them up in Syria today. That was kind of their capital where they were working from. The Ptolemies were down in Egypt. What lies right between those two nations? Israel. Now that's huge. You gotta picture this geographically. The Seleucids in the north, the Ptolemies in the south, Israel's right in the middle, kind of diagonally a little bit if you look at a map. But the reason that's important is Israel becomes somewhat of a speed bump between these two warring nations. Poor Israel, man. It's called here the glorious land. Israel's right in the middle of this battle, and it's going to come into play not only in this story, but also in the end times. So, the king of the south, the Ptolemies, or Ptolemaeus the first, shall be strong, and one of his princes shall be strong above him and have dominion. And his dominion shall be great dominion. And in the end of the years, they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north. And they will make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Huh? What? What in the world's going on there? Well, this is a great story. See, again, it's easy for us because we can look backward into history. Daniel just heard about what? This lady's going to come down and what's going to happen? Well, here's the deal. There's a lady by the name of Berenice, or Bernice, we could call her. Bernie, for real short. And Bernice, she is Ptolemaeus' daughter. Ptolemaeus II, by the way. And Ptolemaeus II sends his daughter up to the north to the Seleucid Empire and has him, for, you know, political reasons, marry his daughter, Bernice. And so this guy that marries Bernice is Antiochus Theos. He's the leader of what is there, the Seleucid Empire. The Seleucids in the north, Ptolemies in the south, sends up their daughter up to the north and says, hey, marry her, we'll be friends, she'll be cool, everything will be great. Well, the problem was Antiochus Theos was already married. And his wife, Laodicea, she said, you can't marry her. And so, and the people said, you can't marry her because you're already married to Laodicea. So he thought, well, man, Berenice is coming up from the south. For political reasons, honey, I'm divorcing you. So he tells her to pack sand, Laodicea. And he marries Berenice. And they're happily married for a while. But after a while, well, the Ptolemy the second dies. And so he's thinking, you know, I don't really need to worry about this peace treaty anymore. And so he says, you know, I'm going back to my old wife. And so he dumps Berenice and goes back to Laodicea. But Laodicea is still a bit ticked. So she stabs Antiochus in the back. True story. She kills Antiochus. And she also, I believe, poisoned Berenice. And she died as well. And so Laodicea comes out the strong one in the end. And her son is going to be the next of the Seleucid Antiochus is in line. So, like I said, the days of our lives. You know, these people are a little bit crazy, but interesting to study at the very least. That's just the Reader's Digest version of that story, but it is pretty crazy. Now, here's what I want to say. This is where the critics start screaming. How could Daniel have known that Berenice would be, you know, this is too exacting about how she will not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, but she shall be given up. Just, I mean, all this thing came down exactly the way this verse says. And so they say it did not happen there, and it's a forgery. But here's where it just cracks me up. Because the Septuagint, which was written and finished before all this came down. The Septuagint. What's the Septuagint? Well, it's kind of like, aren't you glad we have English translations of the Bible? Well, back in the day, they only had these ancient texts of the Bible. And so back in 285 BC, they began a project to translate the entire Bible into Greek. And it's called the Septuagint, sometimes symbolized by the Roman numerals LXX. The Septuagint, it's just the Greek translation of the old of the whole the Old Testament. Now, couple interesting things about that, by the way, for you Bible students. The Septuagint is always the version or translation that the New Testament believers, even Jesus himself, quoted from. So people that say, well, we don't like the Septuagint. We think it was a, well, then you got a problem with all the New Testament believers that were quoting from it, like Jesus and James and John and the others who quoted from the Septuagint. The point is, the Septuagint, it's the real deal. It was a Greek. Now, interestingly, the Hebrew language is it's an emotional language. The Greek language is a very exact language. For example, in the Greek language, for a verb to really be a verb, there's five rules that it needs to have to make it be an accurate verb. And in the Greek language, there are oftentimes many more words that describe one type of the same thing. I think one of our favorite ones to talk about is love. We, in the English language, have the word love. Congratulations. You love puppies, you love ice cream sundaes, and you love your wife. Does that really work? No, because that word's clumsy. You have to kind of, by the context, understand that, well, you really love your wife. You sort of like love hot fudge sundaes and puppies, well, until they mess on the carpet, then you don't love them anymore. But you kind of have to worry about all that. In the Greek language, there are different words for love that describe what kind of love you're feeling, whether it's love for your wife, whether it's a love that's a sexual love or a brotherly love or erotic. There's different kinds of love described in the Greek language. The point? The Septuagint is a very valuable translation of the Old Testament as it goes back to the BC days and gives us in sometimes some description and understanding of what the Old Testament was saying. Sometimes we can have even a little more clarity from what the implications were in the Old Testament Hebrew from the Septuagint Greek of the Old Testament. Does that make sense? It's a helpful tool for you. Now you say, Brett, why are you talking about the Septuagint? Because the skeptics who say this is a forgery and somebody came much, much later and they wrote it, and that's why we know Daniel could not have written it, because this chapter 11, but here's the cool thing. Daniel chapter 11 is in the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament. So they finished the translation, by the way, in 270 BC. So it was started in 285 BC, finished up in 270 BC. And this story with Berenice and everything that happens after this in Daniel chapter 11 happened after the Septuagint already was translated, which proves that this is authentic. It proves that the old book of Daniel was intact as we have it today, all the way back, at least back before 285 BC. Does that make sense? And that's an important thing, especially you college students. Your profs tell you, oh yeah, Daniel, nobody could have figured this stuff out. Well, the Lord did. Gave it to Daniel through this messenger angel, and that's why we have such great detail. The point is, this chapter, if you're bored to death with the history, at least you should be excited that, man, God really does know the beginning from the end. He really does tell us exactly what's going to happen, and it should give you and I greater faith in the Word of God to know that when He says something's going to come down in the future, you better believe it. Because that's what happens here in Daniel chapter 11. Perfect, exactly the way it came down. Well, let's move on. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids are only beginning. They're little feuds and stuff. So it says in verse 7, but out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up. So whose roots? Berenice. Who was Berenice, remember? She was a Ptolemy from the south who was shipped up to the north. So what happens? Well, Ptolemaeus the third, or Ptolemy the third, was her brother. And that's who we're talking about now here in verse 7. One will stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. We see that's what happened in history, by the way. Ptolemaeus, or Ptolemy the third, which he was around 245 to 221 BC. And he was the brother of the murdered Berenice, invaded Syria, seized the port of Antioch, and overran the Seleucid Empire as far as Babylon. You see, this whole thing that came down with his sister took him, made this the brother of Berenice so angry, he went up with the Ptolemy army and just cleaned the clocks of the Seleucid Empire and the Antiochuses all the way as far as Babylon. Now that's why he goes down in history. Ptolemy the Third was known as one of the great leaders of that Egypt time. So he goes down there, and by the way, what does he do? Verse 8, he shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes, with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return in his own land. So that's what happens. This Ptolemy the Third, Bible predicted that he would outlast the northern king, and he did. He lasted 24 years versus the 20 years of the north king. See, all these little details are so specific. But notice, Ptolemy the Third takes the gods of the north and takes them down and steals them. Now, is it just me? Or is that a problem? I mean, if you have gods that you're worshiping and they can steal you away, steal your gods away, wouldn't you just kind of say, keep them? I mean, they didn't work. They didn't help us. Go ahead and keep them. You see, the point is, in the Bible, we see that all the time. These people who wanted so much to worship their little gods, and then people would steal them and they'd get real upset. And they'd have to go and rescue their gods. And, you know, I'm so glad we don't have a God that we have to go and rescue. And yet, you know what? Sometimes we do. Sometimes we think we do. When people are talking about different things and slamming God or talking against the Word of God, oh, there is a place for just defending the Word of God. But I like what Spurgeon says. When people said, man, how do you defend the Bible? And he said, defend the Bible? How do you defend a lion? You just let it out of its cage. And really, in the same way, that's what I love about our God. He's powerful. He's the great, true, and living God. Nobody can steal away our God. Oh, no. People have tried. They've tried to dispute and show that God doesn't exist, and to show that the Bible is inaccurate and full of errors. But why then haven't they been successful? Because God is perfect and He is powerful, and nobody's going to off Him. Nobody's going to steal Him. Nobody's going to move Him. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. We worship a God that doesn't get ripped off. Well, these guys, they lost all their gods. That makes them mad. They're going to come back for another day to fight because their gods are down there with Ptolemy the Third. And they're captive. And so, his spoils, by the way, included 4,000 talents of gold, 40,000 talents of silver. He also had 2,500 of these idols. That's how many he stole, history tells us. 2,500 idols, and carried them to Egypt, and continued there. Well, verse 9, so the king of the south, when he came back to his kingdom, he returned into his own land. And by the way, history tells us the Seleucids reorganized and marched against Egypt, but they got clobbered and returned back to Antioch with only a small, tiny little army. So verse 10, but his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. So again, we're bouncing back and forth. The sons of Seleucus the Second, right around 226 to 223 BC, who was murdered during the campaign in Asia Minor. Now we move then to Antiochus the Third, who is called Antiochus the Great. These guys, Antiochus or Antiochus, depending on how you want to pronounce that. Antiochus the Third, he goes down as the great. Why? Well, because he recovered the fortress of Seleucia and then resumed the war with the Ptolemies down in Egypt. And so there's all kinds of great stories about that. This Antiochus the Great, or the Third, he goes down as really a powerful king, but ultimately got wiped out. Verse 11 continues, and the king of the south, Ptolemies, shall be moved with choler and anger, and shall come forth and fight with him, even the king of the north, and he shall set forth the great multitude, but the multitude shall be given to his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. And so now this brings us to Ptolemy the Fourth, and he's fighting Antiochus the Third, if you're following the Ptolemies and the Antiochuses and what have you. Verse 13,
For the king of the north shall return and set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And so, verse 13, after the death of Ptolemy the fourth, his son, who was 4 years old, began to reign, and succeeded him as Ptolemy the fifth. Now that's kind of an interesting thing, because Antiochus the third set out with a greater army, than before in the conquest of the Egyptian territory. So this little dude now is reigning, this kid, but as he grows up, something happens. Verse 14. And in those times, there shall many stand up against the king of the south, the Ptolemies. Also, robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision before, but they shall fall. So, verse 15, the king of the north shall come up and cast up a mount and shall take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. Now, here's the question. There's some phrases there that perhaps you're starting to recognize. It says there that speaking of thy people and his chosen people, verse 15. But then in verse 16, he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. What's the glorious land? The glorious land, always in the Bible, and there's other passages we could talk about that's speaking of Israel itself, the land of Israel. And that's an important thing for your studies, because we're going to see that in several places. The goodly land, or the glorious land, is kind of the idea. And so what's happening? This is where Israel's getting trounced between these two peoples. The Ptolemies in the south, the Seleucids in the north, and Israel's now becoming in part of the whole thing. The reason this Antiochus here is important, is very simply that he's the now leading up to the Antiochus the fourth, which is the one we want to concern ourselves with the most. And we'll see why in a second. Verse 17. It says there, and he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. Okay, now, this is where we're talking about the Ptolemies, the Seleucids. What's going on here in verse 17? Well, in 197 B.C., Antiochus III set out with a fleet to attack three different countries, Cilicia, Lycia, and Caria, which were under the Egyptian control. But he encountered a disastrous defeat by an interesting little upstart power that was starting to come into the world, and he was defeated by a group on the banks of the Tiber, a little group called Rome. They're starting to come into the play now. The Romans are starting to gain power. That's a problem for these guys, Antiochus and what have you. So what happens? Antiochus seeks to come up with a game plan of how he can take over the Ptolemies. So like back in the days of Berenice, he decides to send his daughter, Antiochus's daughter, whose name was Cleopatra. Does this ring a bell? And that's where we are here in verse 17. Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, right here. In verse 17, when it says that, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. And that's exactly what happened with Cleopatra. They were given in a political marriage to Ptolemy, arranged in 197 BC, consummated in 193 BC. The groom was only 10 years old, by the way, when all this came down. They gave Syria, Phoenicia, and Judea as a dowry for this Cleopatra. That's why she was such a big deal in history. There was quite a feud that this was supposed to settle. But Antiochus all the while was saying, Cleopatra, you're going to be a double agent. You're going to go down there and you're going to hang out there in Egypt. And when the time is right, you will stand on my side and you'll rise up. The problem, when it came time for her to stand up on her loving father's side, she said, nope, I'm an Egyptian, and I like it down here. And so she just stuck with it, and thus it made Antiochus real ticked because his daughter was on the side that he was hoping she would stay. So not only was she allying herself with Egypt, but Cleopatra was also allied with Rome at that time. Now all this is kind of crazy, drama stuff. But isn't it amazing that the Lord just said, this is all going to happen. This lady's going to come down. And now movies are made about it. And we kind of go, hey, yeah, Cleopatra, whatever. But the Lord said, this is going to happen. And again, the Lord knows the beginning from the end. Well, quickly, it says there in verse 18, it says, and after this shall he turn his face to the isles and shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. And so Antiochus here, he turns his rage and again he tries to fight. But these isles, whose isles are these? These are the Grecian isles, and he's stopped by the Romans here. Verse 19, then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Okay, so Antiochus here, he is, that what happened to him? How did he die? Just like the Bible said, he goes to his own land. He's just chilling in his own little temple, and he falls on the steps of his temple and dies. You know, here's a guy who's going out fighting battles, you know, and doing all this stuff and bloody stuff, you know, just going out fighting everybody. And then he goes home and trips on a step and dies. And that's what the Bible said would happen there when it says that he will stumble and fall and not be found. And so that's the end of this Antiochus. Verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. By the way, this Antiochus did raise taxes, and so someone poisoned him with a poison mushroom, and in very short kingdom, he died by this poison mushroom, just like the Bible says here, not in battle, but by a poison mushroom. But let it be known, he was also a raiser of taxes, and he died. Let that be a message to all politicians. anyway, no, just kidding. Anyway, verse 21, now 175 BC, mark it well. This is where we start to sit up and take notice. If you're bored to tears, try to wake up now. Because now we're now down to an Antiochus who's called Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth, who is of great importance in the Bible. We've already studied him a little bit in previous chapters. And this is that Antiochus who the Bible's going to take some time with, because he's a foreshadow of a coming world leader that will really be much bigger and much badder than this Antiochus. But let's read verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. In other words, he's going to come in and he's vile and nobody wants to give him the kingdom, but he's going to end up doing it by flatteries, but also by trickery. He's going to end up becoming the most powerful man in this story just through his own sneakiness, skillfulness, his oratory skills. He's going to come on strong with his own ability to lead. And that's kind of what's being talked about here. And he's a vile person. And verse 22, and with the arms of a flood they shall be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now, this is an interesting description. I wish we had more time to go in. Of when the high priest Onias III in 171 BC was killed. And this is the idea of what happened to the priest there. Verse 23, after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. He shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. So this Antiochus Epiphanes is a guy who comes to power by sneaky stuff, trickery, good leadership, but he's a bad dude. But he also comes up with a small people. That is, they're not little munchkins running around. They're actually, he's got a small army. It's not a big, powerful army like the Medes and the Persians, but more of a Green Beret, Special Forces kind of army. That's how he starts to take over with power. It is interesting, throughout history, the little tiny armies that have done so much damage. You could talk about the Greeks there with Thermopylae. Even Alexander the Great had very tiny armies compared to many of the kingdoms that he subdued. Even in the American Revolution, one of the things when you study the Revolutionary War here in America, we had a small army, and it was by the few that raised up and carved out this great nation. An amazing story there in history. But at the same time, whether it's good or bad, sometimes it's more on the bad side. This is one of those bad examples of how a small group can make a huge difference in a whole nation. I do wonder sometimes about our nation, as our nation was founded by godly men who were small groups of men that came and took on a huge nation, the British. But in the same way, today I worry that there's a small group of men that are fighting to take this nation away, but not by swords or by rifles, but maybe in judges' seats, as our judges are making legislation and laws that are just becoming further and further away from the Bible and from godly heritage that this nation started with. By the small, we see that, whether it's good or bad, throughout history in the world, small groups made big changes in nations. Well, that's what happened here. This guy comes with a small people. Verse 24, he shall enter peaceably, even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his father's fathers. And he shall scatter among them and the prey, the spoil, the riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. Now, this idea of forecasting, it's not just that he's, you know, telling the weather, but he was predicting what he would do, and would make him seem to be almost like deity. And that's something that's going to be characteristic of this guy, Antiochus Epiphanes. He wanted to be taken for a god. Verse 25, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. And so, verse 25, basically after, this all comes down, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids are still going at it, even with this guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, but he's not necessarily the most powerful dude. He's not necessarily gonna wipe everybody out. But read on, verse 26, yea, that, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, they shall speak lies, at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return into his land with great riches. His heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. And at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. What's all this about? Well, in just a nutshell, Antiochus goes down, tries to wipe out the Ptolemies. After this 150-year feud, he says, man, we're going to take these guys out. But he can't. He can't. The Romans are stopping everybody. Antiochus has no power. And so pretty soon, what does he do? He just gets so ticked. He goes back to his own land. Only he turns his anger against the Jews. That's what's being said here. He returned into his land, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant. Who's the Holy Covenant? The Jews. Isn't it interesting that everybody takes their anger out on the Jews historically? And so, not much different here. And literally, we're going to see this guy historically goes in and kills hundreds of thousands of Jews in Jerusalem, but all over Judea and all over the Holy Land. And so, verse 30, for the ships of Chittim, which is, again, the Romans, shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Who's that? Jews. So he shall do, and he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arms shall stand on his part. And they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Now, this is starting to sound familiar. When did this abomination of desolation happen? Well, remember, there's two times that the Bible speaks of that's sort of compared to this abomination of desolation. Last week we saw what that was. Hopefully, if you were with us, we saw, how there they would come to the middle point of the tribulation. Antichrist would set himself up to be worshipped in the temple in Jerusalem. That's going to happen. That's in the future. But here we see a foreshadow or a pre-story of a story. One of the things we see all throughout the Bible in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and even in Daniel is these prophets would talk about near prophecy, but then oftentimes you see their gaze go back further into other future events, and we see that here with the prophecy concerning this Antiochus Epiphanes. And what happened? Well, back when all this stuff came down, right around the 170 BC mark, this Antiochus goes into Jerusalem, takes over, and we've talked about this. He made the priests to worship his gods. If they didn't, he'd make them drink pig's blood out on the steps of the temple. He smeared pig's blood and killed a pig on the sacrifice altar there in Jerusalem. There's nothing worse. This guy knew how to make Jews mad. And yet the Jews had no power against him because he was powerful, military, not power enough to take on the Romans and the Ptolemies, but he was powerful enough to wipe out the Jews in Jerusalem. And that's exactly what he does here. Now, one of the priests that had to, or was told to drink blood and wouldn't, was there, Jaddua, a guy who was not going to do it, not going to drink it. So they killed him on the steps of the temple there. One of his sons, Judah Maccabean, was a guy who was raised up to make a little green beret army and start to take on Antiochus Epiphanes. And that's when this whole thing, the abomination that maketh desolate, took place there historically. So this guy rises up in 165 BC, Judah Maccabean revolt. The Maccabean revolt started, guerrilla warfare, and finally beat out Antiochus and drove him out. And that's what happened. Verse 32. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. I believe that last phrase of verse 32 is speaking of the Maccabean revolt, that those people, the Jews, would raise up against this guy, Antiochus, and drive him out. Verse 33, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword, by flame, by captivity, and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helping with little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them, to purge, and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. Now, did you notice there's a little bit of a shift in language here? We're starting to hear phrases like, even to the time of the end. We've talked about Antiochus Epiphanes and how he committed the abomination of desolation and the Maccabean revolt and how they drove him out and all that stuff that happened. By the way, that's what the Bible even talks about, even kind of mentions this celebration of the Maccabean revolt when they dedicated the temple. After they purified the temple from all the pigs and the killing and the slaughtering that had happened there, they rededicated the temple, the Jews, and that was the festival we know as Hanukkah today. So all this stuff has so much to do with all of history and even things we see and celebrate today. The Jews celebrating Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, the relighting of the candles there in the temple in Jerusalem. It's a great story. But all that's to say, now we're starting to talk about the time of the end, and verse 36 is going to change gears entirely. In fact, the description so far fits all these solutions and Ptolemies to a T. So far, right up to verse 35, we can say, yep, check, it happened, historically it's done, the end. But then there's a little problem. The story keeps going in verse 36, and it does not match up with the story of Antiochus Epiphanes and the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. In fact, it gets even worse, but none of that really happened. So what is it? I believe once again, we're following the pattern of Daniel, and that is the gap. It's that, what I would call the variable, the church age, if you would. And what's going to happen is there's going to come someone out of that region of the world, the same region of the world. Someone's going to come and commit the abomination of desolation. Well, Brett, that already happened. It doesn't need to happen again. And by the way, there are some Bible scholars who would take Daniel chapter 11 and say, see, the abomination of desolation has already taken place. Daniel chapter 9 is fulfilled. Daniel chapter 11 is fulfilled because the abomination of desolation took place with Antiochus. Would you turn over to Matthew's gospel real quick. We're almost done, and we're not going to finish this chapter tonight, so you can be relieved by that. But Matthew, if you turn to Matthew chapter 24, I want you to see something, because basically all of tonight is to set us up for next week when we look at this Antichrist character who's going to be described in the remaining part of Daniel chapter 11. Brett, how do you know the abomination of desolation is going to happen again, or that first one was a foreshadow of the big one? Because Jesus told us that here in Matthew chapter 24. It says there in Matthew 24, verse 15. Matthew 24, 15. We looked at this a few weeks ago. Jesus said, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet." By the way, can I pause just for a second? Remember the critics who say, Daniel's a forgery, and it's not a true book, and we don't agree. The funnest argument, the best argument, is Jesus believed the book of Daniel was the real deal. So, well, do you believe you're smarter than Jesus Christ? Now, as soon as a person says yes, they're in big trouble. Like right there. You know, yes, I'm smarter than Jesus Christ. That puts you in a category. You kind of go, okay. Which I love to do, by the way, because, like, you college students, listen, sometimes that's all you need to do right there. You don't have to defend everything. You don't have to try to talk. Because, listen, there's enough college students in those rooms, even though they're sitting, you know, scribbling their notes at what their professors are, you know, vomiting out of their mouths. You're just there, scribble, okay, yes, okay, yes. But what you can do is say, wait a minute, professor, Jesus said Daniel wrote the book of Daniel. And the prof will say, well, and you say, do you know more than Jesus Christ? And he'll either say yes or something, but the people that are in that room that maybe don't know the Bible, but sort of maybe got saved when they were in kindergarten, and they know Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, but they can't really defend it, and they think, well, these profs, maybe they are right. Maybe the book of Daniel. But as soon as you get into the area of Jesus Christ, and somebody saying, I know more than Jesus Christ knows, even the nominal Christian, the person who just barely, like when they get to heaven, they smell smoke on their coattails, even those people go, yeah, I think that prof is wrong. I think he's wrong. Why? Because you don't know more than Jesus Christ. So all that to say, Jesus said, the prophet Daniel wrote it. He signed his name to it. I love that. So there in verse 15, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee to the mountains. Now that's going to be when the Jews flee to the wilderness of Edom or Moab, which is a place that we're going to talk about next week, because in the last part of Daniel 11, it's going to talk about the Jews fleeing, just like Jesus talked about here. So the point is, we know, we can prove the last part of Daniel 11 doesn't talk about the Seleucids or the Ptolemies. We shift gears in verse 36, because Jesus made that shift right here, saying that the world leader is going to come, commit an abomination of desolation, the Jews are going to flee in the mountains. All of these things we're going to see in the latter part of the book of Daniel. And that's important for you to know. So when you come next week, whether it's Sunday or Wednesday, I'm not sure when we're going to cover the last part of this, but understand this. Now we're going to be talking about this future person, even in our time. In the last days, as Daniel's going to put it, the last days there's going to come a ruler that's similar to Antiochus Epiphanes, but even worse and more dastardly. And I believe it's possible that that man lives in the world today and is poised, perhaps, to take on leadership in the world. And I don't know. It could happen in our lifetime. I believe it could happen soon. And so we'll look at that next week. Daniel chapter 11, the last part. Oh, man, I'm sorry. I hope I didn't bore you to death with all that history. But I'll tell you, aren't you impressed with the Word of God? Like when people say, oh, the Bible, you know, I just don't get what they're saying, because there's no other book in all of the world's history that with such accuracy, even to the most boring details, Brett, Berenice and poison mushrooms and Cleopatra, I don't know about, but the Bible just said that's the way it's going to come down, and it did. When the Lord tells us things in His Word, we just need to believe it. Problem is, we don't like to believe certain things the Bible says. When the Bible says, for example, the way of the transgressor is hard, that's a promise of God's word. Have you named and claimed that promise? See, I love looking at all the negative ones, promises, because those are real too. We always, you know, my God shall supply all of my needs according to his riches and glory. That's a great promise. But it also says those of you that are married will have trouble. It's the promise of God's word. Do you believe the promises? And the problem is the people of the Bible, the Jews, they didn't believe. They didn't believe Daniel chapter 9. And they didn't follow it. And they missed it. They were clueless when Christ came. The second time he comes, I hope he finds a church here at Athey Creek waiting, vigilant, sober, watching. Not messing around with sin. Why? Because we believe from Daniel chapter 11, those little details that we just looked at. And I just, by the way, scratched the surface. I was trying not to bore you guys too much with the detail. But there's some pretty cool stories. They're just total detail. As you look at each phrase of what we just read, it matches up perfectly with what happened right up until verse 36. And if chapter 11, verses 1 through 35 came to pass perfectly, I have every bit of faith to believe Daniel chapter 11, verse 36 to the end of chapter 12 is going to come to pass perfectly. And that's why we should sit up and take notice of the last part of Daniel 11 and chapter 12, because that pertains to us and the future as it relates to the world. So may the Lord give us ears to hear and hearts to be changed as we've looked at this passage. And so, Lord, as we go our way tonight, we're so thankful for your word, Lord, that is living and powerful. You're a God that is able to tell the beginning from the end, and you know the future. Lord, I thank you for these chapters that just confirm your word is the living word that you have given to us. Without error, without mistakes, Lord, it's the perfect, inerrant word. But Lord, I pray that as we've looked at this chapter, that it would have perhaps built our faith in the other passages. Lord, your word tells us that in the last days, that many people would have their conscience seared as with a hot iron. Lord, I pray that that promise, as we see it coming true, that it wouldn't come true with us, but that we'd be people who have our conscience softened towards you. Lord, your word tells us in the last days there'd be scoffers concerning the end times stuff. Lord, but I pray that we would be searching and waiting and watching. Not mocking or scoffing, but Lord, waiting for your soon return. Lord, so many things we could talk about and pray about. I pray, Lord, that we'd be a church that's ready and waiting. And Lord, may we live our lives differently because of it. As we go about this final day or two of the week, as school is coming to a close for this school year, as no doubt summer is getting ready to shift into gear for so many, Lord, I pray that we would be a people who just set our sights on you. Lord, that my brothers and sisters in this room wouldn't be weary in well-doing, but they just keep plugging away. Give them strength, Lord, and endurance to the end. So, Lord, bless, I pray, and thank you for the time tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.